Hi, welcome our architectural family. I think Wes is out securing our financial future, so I'll just start. Yes. So, okay. So, welcome. And I would like to introduce John Howard, who has incredibly graciously come to Alaska to join us and give us this presentation today about some of the research that he's done and all of his wealth of experience and knowledge on the issue of transferring public lands into the hands of the state, federal public lands into the hands of the state. I'd like you to give him a warm welcome for joining us here in Fairbanks. We'll pick up everything.
That's dangerous.
John, why don't you have a chair and just make it comfortable for you as well as us?
Okay.
Like we're having a fireside chat here.
Yeah.
All we need is a fire.
Well, actually, I got to say that the honor is all mine. I've had such a great time here. It's the first time I've ever been to Alaska, and it's wonderful. As I said, I guess a group yesterday. I mean, we have a lot of sun in San Diego, but ours goes down every once in a while, so it's a little different. And I really appreciate it. It was very kind of you to ask me to be here, and I'm glad I'm here. You know, you all know the problem, and you all know the problem of federal ownership of the public land. It's been, who better than Alaskans knows the restrictions and the difficulties of dealing with advancing your interests and your civilization and your state's interests and your commerce when you have 65% of the land owned by the federal government. Your problems are a little different, but very much the same than the western states in the lower 48. The problem that they have is that much land is owned by the federal government in each one of those states. States like Nevada have something like 80% federal. I represented Nye County. It's 93% federal. And it's you can't have a state when that happens, really. It's very, very difficult. And what they have as a problem is that they can't settle. They can't create towns and villages and cities. They can't develop commerce, which translates into something fairly significant. They can't develop the tax base. They can't create the kind of infrastructure that they need for the development of state advancement and wealth. So it's a very difficult problem that they have. Your problem is not quite that bad, as I understand it, in one respect. The state of Alaska has 100 million acres or so that it could be settled. But the difference is, from the other western states in the lower 48, is that you can't get to a lot of it because you got to go across federal land. So it's all separated by a whole lot of federal land that makes it very difficult for you to access and exploit. California has a huge population, and the reason it has, it's a gigantic state when you think about it. It's quite long, nowhere near Alaska, obviously, but it's a huge state. And why is it that it's so settled? Well, the first Governor Brown developed transportation corridors, built roads and bridges and highways so that all parts of California are connected and connected easily. So you have an ease of commerce. You have the ability to create businesses. You have the ability to communicate, you have the ability to interact and create a cohesive state, something that I think is denied Alaska because of the massive amount of federal public land that you have. So there are practical consequences to this, and I like to compare states to the states in the east. You take a state like Pennsylvania, which is one of the largest by land area in the eastern United States, and it has a gross state product of $700 billion a year. Alaska has a state product of $59 billion a year. You have, it has a population of 18 million. You have a population of 700,000, and that's artificially abbreviated and artificially held down. They have 18 congressmen, you have one. So that represents real commercial and political power that you're denied because of the problem of controlling your own land. So how did we get here? I've always felt that the best way to find out where you are is to find out where you were and how you got to where you are now. And I think going through a bit of history will help you, I think, define that. And it also tells you what your solutions or potential solutions are. So I like to start going back before the founding because it sort of informs what it is that we have evolved to and where we came from. Before the founding, the king was the sovereign. The English government owned everything. The English government had all the rights of sovereignty. What are the rights of sovereignty? You can make laws. You can have legislatures. If you want them, you can enforce laws. You can have courts. You can impose taxes. You can collect taxes. You can prosecute criminals. And you own all the public land that isn't otherwise appropriated. So if there's any land in any nation that isn't owned by somebody or by a company, it's owned by the sovereign. It's owned by the government. And that was true in the Americas. So when that happened, it meant that there were reasons for that. I mean, what the sovereign wanted to do was to use that land to create commerce, was to use that land for settlement, to advance the march of civilization westward in the Americas. When the states broke off, when the colonies broke off, they became sovereign states. And I decided after talking to some people yesterday to take a look at the definition of state, which is a nation organized around a political community under a single government. And so what does that mean? It meant that every one of the colonies became a separate state, a separate nation. And they saw themselves as that. When they discussed themselves, they referred to themselves or their fellow citizens as their countrymen, not as their fellow state residents. They were states, independent states, coming together as a group to try to accomplish some purposes, but they didn't have a government and they didn't want to have a government. So these sovereign nations came along independently to run their states independently, but to come together as a group and accomplish something, primarily at that point the revolution. So at that point when they came together, they called themselves the United States, but that wasn't a proper noun. That wasn't a term. It wasn't the name of a country. It was the United Sovereign States coming together, and they came together in Congress, which meant congregating together as a group. It wasn't a proper noun either. Congress wasn't the name of an organization. Congress was the name of a condition. The United States was not a noun. It was a descriptive phrase. And so when you take that together, then you realize that when they broke from the crown, each one of them became a sovereign nation, and each one succeeded to the rights and privileges and sovereignty of the crown, which meant what? It meant they could create a government, and they all created republican forms of government. They could impose taxes. They could grant land. They succeeded to the ownership of all the public land in their borders, and they used it. One of my prized possessions is a land grant signed by my personal hero, Patrick Henry, in which he was granting land to the West so he could promote, as the state of Virginia could promote settlement. They could promote the creation of agriculture at that time mostly, and towns and develop commerce and advance civilization. And that was the purpose. The United States at that time, acting in Congress, did need to have some form of agreement, though, and they needed to have some way of working jointly. One sort of parenthetical I'll say that is until after the Civil War, when people referred to the United States, they would say the United States are, not the United States is. After the Civil War, they would say the United States is. That's when the United States became a real proper noun as the name of a country. So they were meeting during the revolution in something in the Continental Congress, as you all know, and they were trying to figure out what they were going to do. How are they going to raise money to do whatever joint operations they had? They didn't have an agreement. They didn't have a contract. They were just all meeting in Congress to figure out what they had to do. And they, of course, you know, they had a war to run. George Washington kept coming back and saying, you know, my guys need bullets. They kind of need boots. They need some uniforms. I mean, we need help. And they went and passed the hat, and the state said, you know, we just don't have any money. We're sorry. But we'll do what we can. And they explored a bunch of alternatives. And if you look at the debates of the Continental Congress, they talk a lot about those means of raising money. And one of the ways they thought to do it was imposing tariffs. That was a little difficult to coordinate. It didn't generate a lot of money. And at the same time as that they were trying to figure out how to raise money, they also came together and tried to create a contract that would define their relationship to each other and who had what duties to do what. And that was the Articles of Confederation. And that was the subject of quite a bit of debate. There were smaller states that were a little concerned that they were going to be sort of subsumed in the larger states. And the larger states were saying, you know, we've got all this land that we want to operate. And Virginia was taking the position, because the royal charters allowed them to, that they own pretty much everything from where Virginia is today all the way to the West Coast. And New York had the same thing. Those claims were overlapping in many respects. And Georgia's claims were overlapping. Connecticut's claims were overlapping. And they had these massive amounts of land to the west that they owned. Well, two states, primarily, Maryland took the lead, and Delaware said, I'm not really interested much in signing this Articles of Confederation, because we're putting up a whole lot of money, and we're putting up our people, and they're dying in the field like your people. And at the end of the day, when we win this, Virginia's going to own half the nation or more, and be able to outdo us on anything we want. I mean, we won't have any political power. So as a condition of we have a solution that will solve two of our problems. One is that land of the West, you states with all that those land claims to the West have to define your borders, so that you're now finite, you're defined. And we know how big you are, and we know where your borders end. That way we don't fight to get your land for you. And the second thing is, we can take that land and sell it, so we can promote settlement. We can promote the creation of, again, towns and villages and commerce, and we can start to move westward, but we can sell that land and raise the money and put it directly to the uses of our group of people, our group of states that are trying to find a way to operate and win this revolution. And that was the compromise that was struck. Virginia agreed, New York agreed, Georgia agreed, and they signed deeds of cession that ceded all the lands, their lands to the West, all of their claims. It defined their borders so that they were then finite in size. And the deeds of cession said certain things. The deeds of cession said, we're going to give this land. We cede this land to this central government that isn't really a government, this central meeting authority, as it was, is defined by a contract, the Articles of Confederation. And it's to be the term they used was disposed of. It is to be disposed of for the general purpose of supporting what we have to do jointly. And then when you get to 60,000 people in a particular place, then when you finally have a critical mass of people, then you can make it into a state if you'd like to, if you can define the border. And they will then come in on an equal footing with us, so that they'll be equal to us in every possible way, having to do with sovereignty. When I say every possible way, that's actually wrong. They won't come in with equal amounts of territory necessarily. Ohio is bigger than Delaware. They won't come in with the same number of people, because it'll be a beginning. But they'll be equal in sovereignty, which means they'll be able to make laws, they'll be able to have a Republican form of government, which is a condition of the deeds of cession. They will have voting, they will impose taxes, and they will also succeed to public lands in their areas. Except that central government was to hold on to the land after statehood, but sell it. That was what the deal was. It was supposed to sell the land, and therefore promote more settlement and therefore develop more population and more commerce. That was the deal, and that's in the deed of succession. And in fact, what happened, something I didn't know until recently, the federal government, in fact, did that on a consistent basis until 1919. That's how the federal government was funded. That and tariffs. They didn't have anything else. There wasn't an income tax. And so in 1919, until 1919, they continued selling this land, and that's how they funded everything that they did, including their wars, including the everything the federal government had to do was funded by the sale of land. In 1919, something happened, and they stopped selling land, and the reason they stopped selling the land was because they found another source of income. In 1913, they passed the 16th Amendment, and that created the ability for the first time for the federal government to impose income taxes. Too bad for us, but they did. And it had another consequence, which was that in 1914 and 15, they embellished it. In 1916, they did the legislation, and they started collecting the taxes in 17 and 18, and all of a sudden they had enough money they didn't need to sell land anymore. So they stopped selling it in 1919, and that's the reason why if you look at a map of the United States and you look at about a third of Colorado and Wyoming is largely devoid of federal land, everything to the west is pretty much all federal. Certainly, average about 65% federal. It wasn't the deal. That wasn't what was supposed to happen. It was supposed to continue disposing of that land. And so, you know, why is all this important? The reason it's important is because it tells you what was supposed to happen to the land in Alaska. What was supposed to happen to the federal land in Alaska is it was supposed to be continuously disposed of. And there's some in your Enabling Act that says that. Sarah very kindly sent me this. And it's got some interesting provisions. The first provision, in the very first paragraph, it says that Alaska will be declared admitted to the Union or an equal footing with the other states. And that means equal in sovereignty, in all instances of sovereignty. Then you get to the next section 4, where you have a disclaimer. We're going to be talking about the disclaimer in a minute, where you disclaim all this land. But it goes on from that disclaimer to say the United States is going to retain that land until it's disposed of under its authority. So it will retain it until it's disposed of, that federal land. It then goes on to say in a later section that talks about how much of the profits from the sale of land is going to go to the state of Alaska. It says that the United States shall sell that land. And any one of the lawyers in the room or any lawyer that you know is going to say that the word shall has a particular meaning. It isn't will and it isn't may and it isn't can, it's shall. You will do it. It's compulsory. You don't have a choice. So that is, it brings us to one of the theories that is often floated, which is called the compact theory. And the compact theory's theory is that there's a compact between the states. The compact is that federal government will hold that land until it's disposed of, meaning sold or granted, but it will get rid of it at some point. So all the land was intended to have gone to each one to have gone into private hands sometime in the lifetime of the state, sometime within the short lifetime of the state. And that's, in fact, what happened until 1919 for all states east of Wyoming and Montana and Colorado. The compact theory is kind of interesting, and there's a lot of documentary evidence that supports it. The Enabling Act, as I just read to you from the your Enabling Act, the deeds of cession from Virginia and Georgia, especially, make it very clear that that's what was supposed to happen. In a second, I'm going to mention a case to you, and I'm going to read some portions of it to you because I think the language is really quite interesting. Now, I have to say that I've heard before, and it was a famous movie director named Samuel Goldwyn who said a mural contract isn't worth the paper it's written on. So implied contracts are a little bit difficult, but there's enough documentary evidence to suggest that there was, in fact, an agreement, some kind of compact that compelled the federal government to sell that land to be a viable, I think, legal theory. There's another, though, legal theory that I think is even more compelling, and that's the equal footing doctrine. And one of the things we heard the other day was that the equal footing doctrine exists, but it really only applies to the submerged lands. Not exactly. The equal footing doctrine means that every single state comes in on an equal footing with the original 13. So why did I go into so much detail about the incidence of sovereignty? Because every single new state comes in on an equal footing with the original 13, which means the Republican form of government, the ability to have to elect people, the ability to conduct elections, to impose taxes, but the ability to hold on to your public land. And why is that important? It's important because states want to promote commerce. They want to promote settlement. They want to promote growth and prosperity. And that's the reason why they have to come in on an equal footing. It's my belief that it was not really constitutionally right for the federal government to hold on to any of that land, though there's an argument to be made that the original states that gave the land had the ability to hold on to the land, so therefore maybe the title that went to the federal government gave them the ability, gave the federal government the ability to hold on to it until they sold it. But actually, in my view, it should have been turned over to the states when the states were created. So that the land should automatically have been considered state land when they came in on an equal footing. This is not a crazy theory. As I said, from your Enabling Act, you were admitted on an equal footing, and that's in every single Enabling Act ever for any state after the original 13, to emphasize the fact that each one is like the sovereign nation, the sovereign nations that came together to create the United States to begin with. The first articulation of the equal footing doctrine was a case called Pollard versus Hagen, and it was decided in 1845. I think yesterday when I was talking to some people, I said it was 1836, and I maybe just, they say that the memory is the second thing to go, and it may be that that's my problem. In 1845, the Supreme Court decided the case of Pollard versus Hagen, and there's something I didn't point out yesterday that I want to mention today. The Pollard versus Hagen case was one in which the federal government said that they owned a particular amount of land. It was under Mobile Bay, and therefore they had the right to grant it. So there was a contest between people who thought they had gotten a grant from the federal government and somebody who said, no, it belongs to me. The Supreme Court said no. That is land that turned over, that automatically became the state's land on statehood, and only the state then had the right to grant it if it was going to be granted. Now, that particular holding has been misconstrued and I think misrepresented by some people, but misconstrued by many others as meaning that the equal footing doctrine actually only applies to submerged land. They tend to forget one thing. In Pollard versus Hagen, the land was no longer submerged. In Pollard versus Hagen, when this thing came up, the land had become exposed and it was no longer submerged. It was no longer covered with water. And the Supreme Court said it doesn't matter really if it was not covered with water anymore because of the acts of man or the acts of nature. It was, at the time of statehood, covered with water and therefore transferred to the state. Some of the language in this decision is really quite wonderful. The court said, we think a proper examination of this subject will show that the United States never held any municipal sovereignty, jurisdiction, or right of soil in and to the territory of which Alabama or any of these new states were formed, except for temporary purposes and to execute the trusts created by the acts of Virginia and Georgia legislatures and the deeds of session executed by them to the United States and the trust created with the treaty with the French Republic on the 30th of April ceding Louisiana. Both of these deeds of cession stipulated that the lands within the territory ceded and not reserved or appropriated to another purpose shall be considered as a common fund for the use and benefit of the United States to be faithfully and bona fide disposed of for that repurpose and for no other purpose whatsoever. It's particularly powerful language. And so, again, they went on to say, when Alabama was admitted into the Union on an equal footing with the original states, she succeeded to all the rights of sovereignty, jurisdiction, and eminent domain which Georgia possessed at the time of cession, except so far as this right was diminished by the public lands remaining in the possession and under the control of the United States for the temporary purposes provided for in the deed of cession and the legislative acts connected to it. I think also particularly powerful is the words of the dissent. The judge who dissented actually agreed with the conclusions of the majority, but he also wanted to add something to it. And his last thing says, I have expressed these views in addition to those formerly given because this is deemed the most important controversy ever brought before this court, either as it respects the amount of property involved or the principles on which the present judgment proceeds. Principles, in my judgment, as applicable to the highlands of the United States as to the lowlands and shores. So it was the court's decision back then that it actually was an incident of sovereignty, that you would succeed to certain land, and it was automatic. Pollard versus Hagen is in 1845, and so you say, well, gee, isn't that, you know, it's a long time ago. Does that still have any applicability? And it does. It was articulated again in the Utah Division of State Lands case in 1987 in a decision by Justice O'Connor in which the bed of Utah Lake, which for 100 years everybody had thought belonged to the federal government, was deemed to actually belong to the state of Utah. I had an argument at the Court of Appeal where one of the justices says, well, gee, you're making this argument, Mr. Howard, but he said everybody's thought the land belonged to the United States for a long time, didn't they? And I said, yeah, they did. They did. And they thought the bed of Utah Lake belonged to the state of Utah or state of the federal government for 100 years before the Supreme Court said it didn't. So this is something that is that needs to be tested. As recently as 2 years ago, the Supreme Court decided another case, Shelby County case, in the voting rights case, in which they decided that the voting rights law was void as to the southern states on certain circumstances. And the reason for it, they said, was because of the equal footing doctrine, which says that they came in with equal footing and an equal dignity and equal rights with all other states. So, and they cited Pollard versus Hagen and another case, Hoyle versus Smith, which has to do with Oklahoma. And so for those people who say that the equal footing doctrine really applies only to submerged land, first I'd say, what is the principal reason for saying that it only applies to submerged land and not to all land? I mean, tell me the difference. What actually gives submerged land anything different, especially in light of Pollard versus Hagen, where the land wasn't submerged anymore by the time the case was heard? But to that I also say is that the case of Coyle versus Smith, an Oklahoma case, which really tells you the extent of this doctrine, is instructive. Coyle versus Smith, and it's instructive in a couple of ways. In Coyle versus Smith, the state of Oklahoma came in, same kind of legislation, same kind of enabling act. They came under an equal footing with all the other states. They also, one of the stipulations, probably because of the power of landowners in Guthrie, was that the capital would remain at Guthrie. And that was a stipulation, and it was a condition of admission. It was, I think everybody realizes that shortly thereafter, the state of Oklahoma decided to put their capital in Oklahoma City. And so somebody, probably Coyle, probably a landowner in Guthrie, I don't know, sued and said, hey, wait a minute, it's a condition, and we disclaimed it. We said we were going to be bound by it. We said that we were going to keep that capital in Guthrie. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, well, where you put your capital is an instance of sovereignty. You have a right to put it wherever you want to. And so to the extent that, Oklahoma and the people of Oklahoma agreed and contracted and stipulated that they were going to keep the capital in Guthrie, it was void. They didn't have a right to do that because it was unconstitutional. So it doesn't really matter. And they said that you could keep, that Oklahoma could keep their capital where they said, despite the fact that their enabling act said that it was going to stay in Guthrie. In that case, also has some interesting language in it that I hope I highlighted. Yeah. The union was and is a union of states equal in power, dignity, and authority, each competent to exert the residuum of sovereignty not delegated to the United States by the Constitution itself. To maintain otherwise would be to say that the union, through the power of Congress to admit new states, might come to be a union of states unequal in power, as including states whose powers were restricted only by the Constitution, with others whose power had been further restricted by an act of Congress accepted as a condition of admission. Why is that significant to Alaska? Because one of the things that I know you've all heard, certainly, is, look, I don't even know why we're discussing this federal land thing. Why are we even bothering? You people agreed to just claim all right, title, and interest in this land. You did it in the fourth section of your enabling act. You agreed that you were disclaiming it. And my position is that you may have agreed to that as a condition of admission, but it's void just as it was with the people of Oklahoma. It was void just as it was for the people of Alabama with respect to Mobile Bay. And so you don't have the power to do it. Now, there are some also that I've heard in Alaska say, well, yeah, it's part of our Constitution. So we got a little bit of inconvenient fact. We enacted it as part of our state Constitution. And to that I would say is that the problem with that is this. We know recently that the courts of appeal, federal courts of appeal, have made it very clear that all of those states that made and amended their constitutions to ban gay marriage were void. They said, yeah, it may be your constitution, but it's contrary to our constitution, and therefore it's void. So I don't think it matters that it's part of your constitution. You have a right to assert your claims. And you have the power to do it as a state, because a state has the power, unlimited power, to file quiet title actions to get to decide on who owns what land. So it's something that should be tested. It's something that's going to be tested, I think. I just want to bring you up to date a little bit on something that's going on in Utah. In Utah, they have a commission very much like yours that has decided that it's going to explore this issue. They've hired a team of lawyers who are pretty good. My present company accepted. The others are pretty good, though. And we're going to be studying the issue, and we're going to be developing a comprehensive study and a comprehensive brief that will be able to explore this issue in detail. And we believe that when that's done, we don't know what our conclusion is going to be. We do have to be objective. But if the conclusion is, as I think it will be, that this is something that should be explored, then we're going to propose to the Attorney General of Utah that he file suit in the Supreme Court and have it heard. See, just as a matter of sort of bookkeeping, I'll tell you, what is great about this, and what would be great for Alaska, is if Alaska were to act as a state, Alaska would be able to go directly to the Supreme Court. My feeling is I'm hoping that Utah decides to do this. If Utah decides to do it, it sure could use some allies, and it would be nice if it were just more than one state saying this. It'd be great if other states who have the same problem would join in the lawsuit and do it. But one of the things that you have to know is that no federal district judge is going to take none. I can't guarantee it, but I pretty well guess no sitting federal judge is going to say, you know, I want to be responsible for a transfer of about a third of the landmass of the United States of America. It's just a bridge too far for us. And it's probably a bridge too far for the courts of appeal. On the other hand, especially the Ninth Circuit, which wouldn't do it on a bet. But there is one court that I think would. And the nice thing is that when a state sues the federal government, original jurisdiction is in the Supreme Court. So you go directly to the Supreme Court, and it will be heard. And you don't have to worry about whether or not they're going to grant certiorari. So I think it's the time's come. I think it's time for a new first time for the states in the West, in the lower 48, and Alaska, to say, look, this is our land. We can handle it better than you can. We love this land in a way you couldn't possibly love it, because you couldn't possibly know it. And get it back so that they can operate it the way it should be operated. So, for that, anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
And thank you for really an enlightening talk here. What do you foresee would be the argument by the Supreme Court against this this theory? At the present time, it hasn't been tested, so I'll call it a theory.
Yep.
What do you foresee as the argument against, other than the fact that the court may be exercises political power, not really its strict judicial power? What do you see as the real roadblock? There's got to be some, because I can't envision the court just saying, oh, you're right, let's turn this one third of the nation over to the states. It's got to be. It's either going to be the environmentalists who exercise some power in there somewhere, it's going to be somebody. But what do you see as
a
real roadblock?
There are a couple of things. I think the actual decision will turn on a couple of things. The decision will turn on whether or not the ownership of public land is an incident of sovereignty. And I don't know what – I can't imagine anybody concluding that it isn't, because I can't imagine what would be a closer incident of sovereignty than the ownership of public land and operation of and control of public land. And certainly we go back to what happened in the original 13 when the public land went to those states and to Kentucky, Tennessee, and Vermont, which were the next three that were admitted. So it would turn on that, I think, whether or not that's an incident of sovereignty. If I were on the other side, that's what I'd argue. And in fact, they have argued that before. I didn't mention there have been two cases on this, and I handled both of them, and that's the good news. The bad news is we lost both of them, but the reason we did is that we were suing for counties, not states. And so the federal government, as it often does when it's losing an argument, changes the subject, and they decided that it was a quiet title action, which Scott there knows all about. And a quiet title action has a statute of limitations, and the statute of limitations is, I think, 7 years. But for a state, there isn't one. So the state can still sue for a quiet title act, on a quiet title act, and say, you know what, it belongs to us. So I think that's one of the issues. And I think the second thing it would turn on is, let's say that they said, you know what, you guys are absolutely right. That was originally what was supposed to happen. What do we do about it? And that, I think, is the second, probably just as dangerous issue. They could say, well, okay, you mean we're going to just conclude that land automatically belongs to the states? Really? Is that what we're going to conclude? And the answer is, I don't know. I think that's going to have to take some real care. I think the court, if it concludes we're right, would then say, so great, what's the remedy here? Do we just turn it over, or do we sell it? Or do we then put it on the market, which might be, you know, a little dicey, frankly, for the western states, because I think a lot of people would say, are you kidding? You think I want the Mojave Desert? I mean, what am I going to do with it? Well, it's solar farms, which Diane Fine signed against, and there we are. Scott.
Two questions. What about previously withdrawn lands, like wildlife refuges, national parks, military was constitutional?
nobody would have the standing to intervene. There's no, except somebody who was a landowner whose property was in jeopardy because of that. I think, and there probably would be interveners on that basis. One of the things that was misconstrued with respect to the Utah case was there's language in there saying, well, you know, if you're going to, they could have withdrawn some land. And so we're not going to lightly infer that they did withdraw some land, and that would have defeated the state's claim. And they used that language to beat us over the head. The problem is that when you take that language in its context, what they mean by that is that when you admit a state, what you do is what every single time from Vermont forward, when you admit a new state, the titles that already exist are recognized. So in the Southwest, for example, Spanish land grant titles were recognized. So if you already owned it when it was a territory, you didn't lose them. That didn't become void. So that is if the federal government had decided, for example, before Utah became a state, that they were going to sell that bed of Utah Lake to somebody who said, "I want to own the bed of the lake," that title would have been there, and so they could do that with respect to certain things. I'd say that they also have title to, under the Constitution, they can own arsenals and forts and other needful buildings, they say, for the operation of the federal government. But that doesn't mean the entire national park. I honestly think that if we succeed in this, the national parks would go to the states. If I were the states, I would be saying we don't want them. But now, as somebody told
me,
well, it might be different in Alaska, where there's a whole lot more. The national parks are bigger. No, that PRE would probably become, because you can't give it to yourself. The federal government can't defeat the state's equal footing right by saying, well, we decided to keep it. We granted it to ourselves.
What's the difference between now and the late 70s and early 80s when the major move of state rush state that was happening? What did you guys know that they didn't know, or what happened?
They didn't understand the equal footing doctrine as well. They didn't understand the history that informed it. Part of the reason I took a lot of your time, and I apologize for that, going through that history with the Continental Congress, is to explain what it was that they actually intended to do with that land, what they really were supposed to do, and the disposal and what that actually meant. They've chosen to interpret disposal as meaning holding on to it. Well, that's not, in my view, certainly not in the English language, disposal.
Does the fact that we were a territory at one time influence any of these court decisions?
No, because most of them were territories. Nevada was a territory, and New Mexico was a territory, included both New Mexico and Arizona. The only thing it would mean is that the titles that had been transferred before statehood were still recognized. We met in Utah.
Yeah.
Nice to see you.
To
be honest, I think as a matter of politics, I wouldn't go for the national parks because the public relations of this,
I agree with that,
in the East Coast is they're trying to steal our national parks. Those bastards in the West want to take our national parks. They're our birthright. And I think it would be a strategic mistake to say we want the national parks. I do think it might be great as a matter of negotiation, though.
So you have one case here where, as a part of being reasonable, we said we're not looking for some particular portion of something, whereas if we had advanced legal argument on everything, the whole legal argument might have been taken more seriously because it would have applied to everything equally. And now you're making it.
is your legal argument that there shouldn't be any distinction between those sets of land?
Yes.
Is there, so other than military things,
right,
maybe the several other constitutional things.
And anything that they sold to anybody else.
Okay. But other than that, those things should all be categorized as the same thing for purposes of society.
Yes. But again, I don't know. You know, you may have a point there. It may be it may weaken our argument by saying we're not going for the national parks. You may be right about that. I'm just thinking of it as from the public relations standpoint. But
right.
But you may be right that we should go forward and say we want the whole thing. And
I
then
want to be the person saying that I'm encouraging that.
Well, to tie into that, an argument for the state taking all those national parks along with all the other land is really get some traction by letting people know that there is no state government that ever dropped in the common farm land.
Well, yes. Which I guess ended up killing the entire cast of The Conqueror. John Wayne himself. So,
obviously, Utah had a tax legislation just passed, and you folks put together the legal efforts you put together are way ahead of any other state.
Yes, but you know, this has been going on. I've been working on this issue for 25 years.
So I understand the tax. My point is that you're a lot further down the road filing an action with the Supreme Court than anybody else is.
Yes. If that's going to happen.
And it seems to be the other states, the last included, that want to be deliberately and purposely and maybe with some effect involved, should, what's the avenue that we assist Utah? Because if you were to win big, that would affect all of us.
True.
And so it seems to be the best way to use our efforts in all the towns we have is to help Utah win this.
Oh, I agree with that. And I think one of the things that you're going to benefit from is that I don't know how long our – I saw some joke one time where a guy had something in his papers and he said only a lawyer would call out a brief. But the brief that we're going to do is going to be comprehensive. It's going to go through the history. It's going to go through the various arguments. There are other legal arguments to be made, equal protection being one of them. But are going to be reduced to a brief that's going to be a comprehensive study of this. And you guys will be able to, your legislature will be able to look at that and say, well, we want to be part of it or not.
Just a quick follow-up on that. All the details we discussed yesterday, all significant details for the last in there. If you don't win, there are things we have to deal with. But if you do win, a lot of them go away.
True. That's true.
What about do violations of state compacts on other issues besides equal footing play in, for example, I'm not an attorney, okay, but I can't get past my spirit, if you will, and my the knowledge that I've gleaned about law that we were our compact was violated when we were guaranteed the rights of 103 million acres, and halfway through that process, they went, "Well, wait a minute, we're going to PLO all this out, and we're going to do these subsequent acts of Congress, including, you know, native claims." And that's another question about how do native claims play in on that? But because we don't have sovereign tribes here, we have these native claims with for-profit corporations. But sorry if I got down a separate bunny trail, but we. In my opinion, we got ripped off because we entered with a good faith understanding in our compact that we were going to be able to select all this unappropriated federal land. So we were kind of lackadaisically working through that process, and they jerked the rug out from us and said, "Oh, wait a minute." And I talked about it the other day on the record, but I don't know if that plays into our situation or not. I mean, it's different than any other state, I think, but I think it's part. I really, in my heart, I believe it's a breach. I mean, in my heart and soul, I just everything about me, every fiber about me, believes that was a misrepresentation, and they
breach of our compact.
Well, based on what I read of your enabling act, I think it was too. I mean, you have absolute rights under that. I haven't seen an enabling act where that same thing happened, by the way. I haven't, in Utah, there wasn't the enabling act didn't say, by the way, we're going to give you a, 200,000 acres. It didn't say that. It said, we're going to keep everything that's public land and everything that's been granted you can have. So that's why they have what they have. But I don't know how you would enforce that except to bring another action and say, look, this is a breach of contract. That's what a compact is, after all. I don't know if there's a statute of limitations between the state and the federal government.
That would be my question.
See, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if I don't know if there's a brief, I don't know if there's a if there's a statute of limitations on states for anything. But certainly, I can tell you under the Quiet Title Act, they were very specific that there was a that there's a brief, that there's a statute of limitations that doesn't apply to the state. Warren?
Two things. The worst political decision ever made by Ted Stevens and ruining other people that came from other places was combining the National Park Service with the Alaska Wildlife. We can't exist with the Park Service. They can't and they won't abide by our Constitution. They won't abide by abundance. They won't abide by increasing natural resources in any manner whatsoever. I think we've got a white paper be very interesting for you to review from a think tank in Colorado that is one of the most eye-opening things I've ever read. I think Stan could find that thing. I keep losing the damn thing. It's startling how far out of phase these people are. And here's what's going to happen. The Native people and the rural folks are going to ask the National Park Service to leave Alaska. I may not see it, but I'll guarantee you the next generation and the generation after, that's going to be a formal request. So you really got to realize that. My question is, what is the relationship between the Supreme Courts of the states and the Supreme Court of the United States? We have decisions within the state that should have swept aside a great amount of this problem with the federal government. But
well,
unfortunately, we've had administrations that have, lost the bus ticket, deliberately so. But there's a special, unique relationship between the state Supreme Courts on untitled property rights and sovereignty versus the Supreme Court of the United States. It's an area that the Supreme Court won't walk into when Supreme Courts of states make sovereign issues in regards to their sovereignty.
Well, but the Supremacy Clause puts them ahead of the state courts with respect to things that are that the Supreme Court of the United States can hear.
True, but untitled property rights and things that we own this land. The king did not, he transferred the property issue to the states, but the state actually, as a former Governor Hickel described, hey, I'm the foreman of the property, and you folks own the lands, the waters, and the fish, and everything else. We own it. And so when you get into the Supremacy Clause and all these buzzwords, that's to be tested. They're not going to wander down that road, and at least I'm speculating this.
Well, then that reminds me of the thing that you just asked, Bud, was what would be the other argument? That would be one of the arguments, is the Supremacy Clause, because they argued that before. Say, well, look, we've got the Supremacy Clause. It means we can do anything because we're the federal government. And that's just not true.
No.
That's not what the Supremacy Clause means. It just isn't. The other thing that you'll find is that they will engage in a certain amount of public relations terrorism. by saying to the counties or the school districts, okay, you guys aren't going to get your PILT payments anymore. You're going to go broke. And by the way, when your forest catches on fire, you're not going to be able to afford to fight the firefighters. You won't have enough money to have firefighters. You know, the whole state's going to burn down because you don't have the federal firefighters and the federal money to pay for firefighters. I'm just here to tell you, and I don't know because you guys know this better than I do. I don't actually have any facts or figures. My feeling is that if you guys were able to open up Anwar, you'd probably be able to pay for a lot of firefighters. So. Well, when I was talking to Scott yesterday, I mean, I was saying that, the East Coast people say, well, you know, we send a lot of money to you. You guys get a whole lot more of the tax money than we do. And my answer to that is, you know, give us our land, you can keep your money. And we can handle it ourselves. We'll make enough money with the land we've got to be able to do this. And we're not going to be bulldozing over it. I mean, the other thing that I've often found offensive is I think that the people of these states, people of Alaska are not to be trusted with their own land. Are you kidding? And they're thinking that we're going to bulldoze over. I don't live in Utah, but I think the Utah people are going to go bulldoze all the hoodoos in Bryce Canyon and fill up Zion and put up a housing development. It's absurd. They love those places. They love them certainly more than any New Yorker who tramps around once every 6 years.
The state of Alaska has the largest state park system in the country. Yeah, state park. We have a good track record in that regard.
Because you love this land more than anybody else does.
Fisheries, for example, if we stay there, the fisheries were in a shambles because it was under federal management. We got a pretty solid fishery. We got problems. We always will have, but pretty solid commercial fishery.
You mean you think the federal government doesn't necessarily handle things all that well?
I'm sorry.
Yes.
I do think that it's stewardship. It brings up a good point of stewardship. If you look, if you side by side example of the state of Alaska versus the federal government and stewardship of the land, they're the biggest polluter in the state. There's uncapped wells that have been selling oil for the last, 50 years? And still they haven't cleaned up. Not to mention the atomic waste. Not to mention everything else that's been dumped that we don't even know of. Every time they've been dropped bulldozer blades on a military installation, they discover something in the coal left over. So, I think we can easily make the case. The state has been a much better steward of its resources than the federal government has on Alaska's resources.
I can tell you that one story I told yesterday, and it's when I first got involved with this issue, it was for New Mexico. And if you drive north out of Alamogordo, and I mentioned this, you're driving up toward High Rolls and Rodoso. On the right side of the highway is the federal, and the entire thing is Lincoln National Forest, which, by the way, is where Smokey the Bear was found. And on the right side is run by the federal government and the Forest Service. On the left side is run by the Mescalero Apaches. And the Mescalero Apache area is gorgeous. It's like a park. It's just beautiful. Trees are healthy. The underbrush is healthy. Everything is healthy. On the other side, that forest is choking to death and has been forever. And if anybody drops a match, it's going to go up like a torch. And that's because the federal government won't let you do anything. On the left side, they have grazing. They have mining. They have other uses. It's making for a healthy forest.
I just heard a report yesterday on CBS Radio, I think it was coming up here, that mentioned tribes in California are pushing to create meadows in the Sierra in order to prevent the droughts that they're having now from having an effect.
Well, if we could just get the federal government and the courts to stop making us flush 70% of our water out to the ocean to save the snail, it's a little minnow.
Delta smelt,
yeah.
Yeah, and the premise there in here, too, was there's a vast amount of underbrush here because that vegetation is doing nothing but sucking the resources out before it gets to where it needs to go.
Susan?
Yeah, I've got a couple of things. First of all, how does an international tree, like, how does that
glad you asked that second part. The first one, I don't really know the answer. I mean, generally, the supreme law of the land is the Constitution, but the treaties are very powerful and sometimes can get us in trouble because they overrule pretty much everything else. So I don't know what the treaty is, and I don't know what it says, and I would be misinforming you if I were to give you an opinion on that. I just don't know. The other one is, though, that's right. That was the next thing that happened after 1919, is in the Taylor Grazing Act in the 20s and 30s, as they were developing. The FLIPMA came along and changed everything. That's when the federal government officially said, we're not going to sell land anymore. So that was, 1976? And so it was, 60 years later, they decided, after 60 years after they stopped selling land, they decided they weren't going to sell land anymore. But I think that's void. I don't think that matters. It matters it doesn't matter for the compact theory. If the compact theory is right, they have a contract that they have to live by and dispose of that land. And as you can see from that Pollard case, it's pretty powerful language that's what they were supposed to do. And they, in other parts of the case I didn't read you, were where they're talking about the provisions of the land, deeds of cession. I don't think FLIPMA has actually ever been challenged on that basis, but it ought to be, because it's they don't have the right to say we're going to stop selling the land. And if we win on equal footing, they're going to say, well, you don't have to sell land anymore. It's always belonged to the state. So whether you say you want to sell it or not, you're going to be in the same position as the federal government was in Mobile Bay when it purported to sell land that didn't know it belonged to the state.
If we win on the equal footing, will that basically then negate the thing like the compact language that says we forever relinquish or whatever? You know, I mean, that's the question. And I also want to say, I'm sure I think you looked at HB 115 that Speaker Schnall put in.
I did see that.
And I signed my name on it.
No, some of it bears repeating. I mean, I did cover part of it. The thing that they're going to jam down your throats is the disclaimer clause. They're going to say you forever disclaim this, but keep in mind that disclaimer clause, first of all, had a second part of that sentence. The disclaimer said, we're disclaiming it, and you can retain it until you dispose of it. You can retain it until you dispose of it, and then later in the Enabling Act it says that the federal government shall dispose of it. But then there's another case that I mentioned earlier, and it's called Coyle versus Smith, and it has to do with the location of the capital of Oklahoma, in which the Supreme Court said, look, you can't disclaim this. You don't have the power to say to relinquish the power as a sovereign, put your capital wherever the heck you want to. And so the disclaimer language doesn't really matter in the face of Coyle versus Smith, in my view, because you can't disclaim something that you have an absolute right to. What could happen, you can understand the reasoning, because let's say that you said, you know what, we want to make a new state out of something we own, but we're not going to let you have a government. We want everything is going to be done by the federal government, so you can't pass laws. Well, an instance of sovereignty is having a government and passing laws. Well, we're going to make it a condition of your statehood that you can't impose taxes. You just can't do that. It's not constitutionally permissible under the equal footing doctrine.
Well, except that was reserved specifically for that.
Yeah, you mentioned the constitutional prohibition. I mentioned again. The Sun Rebellion, I read that, and I remember all of that.
Well, then it's an honor to be in your presence.
Yeah, right. And it passed in the state 7-3, by the way. And then the Attorney General did, in fact, discuss the election. And during the course of the campaign, we all made it very clear we knew it was in violation of our Constitution and our Constitutional Compact, but we, the people of Alaska, can change our Constitution.
Right.
And your legal arguments that we can, in fact, deal with the Compact also. So, yeah. Just because somebody
before
you says something so, it doesn't necessarily make it so.
True. And I would say that what you just said is true. I mean, that may be in your constitution, but I don't think it's I don't think it's constitutional.
A great deal of our state constitution is unconstitutional. But that's another issue.
The tribes have an original jurisdiction. Apache Indian tribe, but they go directly to the Supreme Court.
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, that's something that we'll have to deal with at some point. I mean, we're not asking for the tribal lands to come back because I don't think we can. And I don't know, I hate to display my abysmal ignorance for everybody to see, though I do it with some regularity. I don't know exactly what the actual situation is between Indian law and how that interplays with the rest of the land. I believe their treaties are paramount and they can't be undone just because you say that the land should go back to the state. I think that's true, but I don't know that. So I'm not researching.
Of course, here we don't really have Indian country, so to speak. That could change. Then we have corporations, which of course are private corporations, and they had their land selection on the Native Claim Settlement Act. But it doesn't stand to reason if the state were to file an original jurisdiction case in the Supreme Court, there would be a lot of people with their interests. And we have 226 tribal entities in the state of Alaska.
Yeah, somebody told me that's half of all the Indian tribes in the country.
It's just about half. It's about right.
Well, I guess there's states about half the landmass of the United States.
But there's kind of a catch to this. It wasn't until Ada Deers basically slipped some legislation through that made these tribes. Before that, there were not basically tribes in the state of Alaska. So the claim settlement, ANCSA and the NILCA both, were adopted before tribal status was legislated for the Alaska Native, which makes it a little bit, it bogs the picture up to me a little bit, because original jurisdiction I don't think they have, but there's other legal matters, whether or not they fall under, for example, the Indian Reorganization Act, or how much they fall under. It's not really a clear picture.
And the Native Claim Settlement Act extinguished claims to use and occupancy, and claims to any land based on use and occupancy, and extinguished any aboriginal land division rights. Very
interesting. But would that legislative action be similar to the disclaimer?
Well, right, and I think that's something everybody really needs to be cautious of, the law of unintended consequences, because if the whole thing is opened up, this free-for-all, then we may be going back and not only resettling a whole bunch of things that of unsettled state business, but it might create a whole bunch of unsettled native business and cast clouds on title all over the state, to the point of, who owns the pipeline route now, and all the things that we reasonably settled in claims, and yada, yada, yada. There could be a whole snowball of fun.
But a lot of tripwire.
I don't think any questions.
If your theory is correct, I
By the federal government.
They write it directly from the feds to the data corps.
But that could be considered a disposal, right?
Not if it wasn't theirs to dispose. I mean, that's the whole basis of the...
That's the thing. It was theirs to dispose of, right? They were supposed to dispose it.
Yeah, see, and I think that you try both arguments, not knowing which one is going to hit and whether or not it would be a hybrid of the two. But I think if equal footing is right, they didn't have the right to even retain it. I still think that that was not constitutionally permissible when they did it. I shouldn't say that. When they did it, I think it was constitutionally permissible because it was land that was given by mother states like Virginia and New York and Georgia. And they had the right to retain that land if they wanted to. So you, I think, could make an argument that the federal government had the right to retain that land. But when you got the Louisiana Purchase and went west, you didn't have a right to do that because there was no right in the mother state to retain that land. That gets a little more complex.
That could be something that could be. So that sort of leads to my question, which is, what is your timeline for objective briefing that you were talking about earlier?
You know, we have, we were awarded the contract Monday.
Okay.
So we haven't signed it yet. And we guess we would sign between the next 2 weeks,
okay,
to a month. We just don't know for sure. And then we're going to start our work in earnest, and we're going to work as fast as we can. We do have a few deadlines. My guess is that we're going to try to hit a comprehensive briefing while the legislature is sitting next year. Just so you'll know, because you'd be familiar with this. I mean, the legal team we put together is terrific. We have a guy named Richard Seaman, who's a professor of law at the University of Idaho, who was with the Solicitor General's office and has argued some 15 or 20 cases at the Supreme Court, which is important. But the one I think will really impress you is one of our team, and supporting us, is Ronald Rotunda, who wrote the 6-volume treatise on constitutional law. It is the Bible on constitutional law. And Richard's very much in our camp. I mean, he signed on to do the bid. I read some of his credentials last night to some people. It goes on for pages and pages and pages. It's just amazing.
Another question. There's been some discussion on...
Did I say Richard? I meant Ronald.
Right.
Will there be some public element of that briefing so that it can be shared with other folks so we can start getting a better handle on what you guys want us to think about signing on to or participating in?
I don't know how the extent to which anything will be released before the final product. I don't know that. We haven't really talked about that. You know, I think probably nobody's going to keep it a big secret, but I don't think anything written will be released until the final thing is in it, because we really do have to have it vetted. I mean,
sure.
Part of the reason for Ron Rotunda's being there is because we want him to go through it, all of our arguments. I mean, he's the one who told us about the Shelby County case, and, you know, we all read it and sort of went through it and didn't realize that equal footing was such a big part of it.
I'll give you two things to add on your to-do list. You don't need to answer them now. So one is we have lost, not completely, but we've lost a compact case in Alaska. And specifically on the compact theory, not the whole, there's a whole state of that is a compact, but at least one provision of it is not a compact. So that's something that would be law for other states. It could be a problem in this case for other people. I think the state, everybody can correct me if I'm wrong, and nobody's ever been shy about that before, but I think it's made us a little bit gun-shy about taking on another case. We know the next case is going to, if we lose the next case on our State of Act being a compact, that theory is going to be dead for us.
Is that a Supreme Court case?
No,
it's Ninth Circuit. Oh, Ninth Circuit. Okay, well, nobody takes that seriously. least of all the Supreme Court of the United States.
You know, the short answer for a lot of what folks have talked about in terms of westward expansion and west states are mostly federal lands or more than half federal lands in which they aren't. When you look at the order of admission, and there might be good answers as to why this is the case, but if you look at North Dakota and South Dakota. There's almost no federal land. You look at Montana, it's some huge percentage of federal land. The dates of admission are 6 days apart. You look at something like Oklahoma, it wasn't admitted until 1907, nothing. But, you know, Nevada was the first, actually, of all the sort of western states, right? They were admitted during the Civil War. So it's, from a factual standpoint, yes, there's a general trend, but there's enough specific instances where the trend doesn't hold that it's a question that we need to be answered. And I don't think 1918 is, it helps explain why a lot of it stopped happening after that, and then the Taylor Grazing Act and the FLIPMA. But there's a lot of questions about what happened before and why it wasn't. Someone looking at it, you go, the easy answer is a lot of this had terrible land. Nobody wanted to settle it. It didn't get sold. That may be what factually happened. I don't know. I think North Dakota and South Dakota have large reservations, so that might answer part of the question. I know Oklahoma has large reservations, and also has probably several large military installations also. So there may be factual answers to those questions. Those are the kinds of things that, you know, when you start digging into the details beyond, you know, us sort of getting a flavor of things, that need to be answered.
Well, let me mention
Hawaii too.
Hawaii was a very different. Hawaii was its own sovereignty. There's an answer to Hawaii that we don't have for the rest of the West.
Which is why Texas has no public land. Came in as an independent nation, and it has no public land, or virtually no public land. I mean, federal public land. And that's God knows there are huge swaths of Texas that are no less unattractive.
They got interesting around 1920 when someone started to figure out that there was some stuff under the ground.
And I don't know. I mean, I've been up here. I've been told that they knew about oil up here long before I ever thought they did. So.
It was geologized basically at about the time of the Teapot Dome scandal in Wyoming, which is about 1923 or thereabouts. And that's when they begin to actually do some geologic work on seeps that occurred, oil seeps that occurred on the North Slope. And that's when the Arctic contractors, or not the Arctic contractors, but the reserve, the Arctic reserve, NPR, called NPRA today, the Naval Reserve Number 4, replaced this, I think, in 1923, right after the Teapot Dome. They needed the Naval Oil Reserve.
it's a question. What's your experience in California with the effect of sequester really is a camel's lies for bankruptcy? They should call it what it is. Bankruptcy is driving a truck back in D.C. We see it all the way from military expenditures to all kinds of things are being cut back. We've had a dramatic reduction in federal employees here. Also, seasoned federal employees, environmentalists, are crying like babies right now because they can't walk into these offices anymore and have somebody, Uncle Fred, you know, that they had for 35 years of Anilka sitting there sweet talking them. They've got new managers now, and they're crying about it. But what is the effect of this bankruptcy on a state like California? And I think personally that this is going to drive, in fact, I'm absolutely convinced that this state should go after the refuges first. We have the talent, we have the experience, we have the background to manage those tomorrow. And the fact is that I think it's driving the bus. What's your experience of your state and consequences of the bankruptcy coming from, like, a steamroller from D.C.?
Well, coming from the People's Republic of California,
yes.
Our franchise tax board, just as an example, makes the IRS look benign. We have a California Environmental Quality Act, and we have three different departments of environmental things. Just like we have three different departments of education. stupidest thing I've ever seen. And they are just aggressive. So I don't think the environmentalists have missed a trick in California. We have an Administrative Procedures Act. We have a Private Attorney General's Act, all of which is even worse than the federal act. So every little freelance lawyer who feels like he has a bone to pick on the environment files a lawsuit under the California Environmental Quality Act and gets an award of attorney's fees. You know, because the courts are saying, oh, well, the California courts are saying the highest value that we have of anything at all is the environment. I mean, it's just the way it is. And in interest of full disclosure, I just recently filed a California Environmental Quality Act case, because if I can use that tool against the government, then I do. But I don't think there's any difference, because I don't think the federal government really needs to be there. The state of California really does more than you can imagine. We even have a coastal commission that'll stop you from doing a remodel. And there's also, I don't want to get into too much politics, but there's this sort of enviro union, coalition now in California, so that if there was a huge complex being contemplated for a little city south of San Diego, and they said they weren't going to hire union workers. And so the environmentalists went to the Coastal Commission to tie them up and make it as miserable as they could, which they would have withdrawn if they had said, well, okay, then we'll hire union workers. And the company said, you know what, we're going to spend $1 billion down here, and we'll maybe go somewhere else, and they did. So California is a unique case, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned management. If there is some move for the state to take over management in certain areas and include the native corporations in that management, huge sections of land, especially in fishing game and even some land management, will that interfere with any effort to transfer lands outright?
As long as you don't sign any agreements to say, okay, we're going to let you have your land. I mean, because the federal government can own land if the state says they can. If the state says, okay, we're going to give you some land or sell it to you or something, they can own the land. They shouldn't, but they can. And so you want to make sure that they come to a settlement.
Your management contract.
Yeah, because you don't want a management contract that says, we recognize your ownership of the land, because then that's going to hurt you.
Isn't that what land is a trust is?
Sorry?
Isn't that what land is a trust is?
Well, that's the language from Pollard you're talking about, yeah. Well, the land was supposed to be held in trust only for disposal. I still don't think I understand why it worked, why people did it. Glad that the government was funded. I still say, I mean, this is my first time to the last battle. It's not the last, and I got to tell you, I mean, everybody I've met, it's clear to me that Alaskans love their land more than the federal government does, and they can handle it better and know how it works and manage it better than any federal employee. I don't care how long the federal employees live here. There's an emotional connection. At least that's my impression.
It's a beautiful spot outside of Fairbanks, right?
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Is that West Bank?
Anyway,
hi, Representative.
Anyway, you can land a football.
Means that if you have statutes or rules or even constitutional provisions that are contrary to the federal statutes or constitution in areas where the federal government has the power to act, then the supremacy clause
overrules your state laws. It's like the, again, the gay marriage thing has been one of the biggest and recently. And supremacy clause is powerful, but it only applies if it's in something where the federal government has the right to have a rule or to have a statute. For example, you know, I think a lot of people here know about Wayne Hage and his lonely and long fight in Nevada. The final decision in that was that it's state water law that determines everything with respect to water rights. And the federal government's supremacy clause had no way of overruling state law on that, because the federal government doesn't have the right to make regulations that interfere with state law on something that's uniquely a state prerogative.
You tell the reserve water rights doctrine. This is a very ominous thing in Alaska.
Well, at least you guys have water.
Yeah.
We'd like to sell it.
Yeah. Well, I know someplace out there would probably be happy to build a pipeline and pipe it in. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's a great, great honor to be here. Thank you so much.
We had a good time with your buddy today.
Oh,
with his boat. Oh, he took us around and we got some really good stuff on the boat.
Great.
Interviewed him on the boat in front of a beaver.
Great couple.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Oh. Yeah, I know. We're going to take that, and that's how we're going to introduce you.
What do you think about that?
That was a kick. That was a good ad. That was a great ad.
But we're going to. That's the way we want to bring you in. Is that all right?
Yeah.
No, he's
sure.
He is a great support. Oh, this guy is incredible. You know, he's been designing.